Coming up on Triangulation, Meredith Broussard is here. She's going to talk about her new book, Artificial Unintelligence, about how computers misunderstand the world.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Triangulation, episode 383, recorded December 10th, 2018, for February 1st, 2019. Meredith Broussard, Artificial Unintelligence. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show that every week we speak to some of the most enlightening, fascinating people working in tech and writing about tech. And today my guest does both and has an interesting story about why she's does more writing than tech, or more tech writing. We'll have her explain it. Meredith Broussard is a professor at NYU, a data journalist, a programmer, and author of the book Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World, basically about how AI does not do as much as you think. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I love this book. I love the premise because I think it's so much of what we grew up with. You say the years you were in college, so I think we're about the same age. So I think we had the same similar experience of the early 90s being in college and just thinking that technology was going to solve all our problems. It being sort of while we were in college, sort of the birth of the internet. Kind of, you know, not as we know it, but of course it was there, you know, back in the 70s, but it was a different kind of internet. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You start with the book, with your childhood, your experience with a robot. So tell that story.
So when I was about 7, my parents bought me for Christmas an Erector set, which was this fantastic kit where you got like little pieces of pierced metal and little tiny child-sized wrenches and screws, and you could put together a robot. And so I was so excited about this robot, and I thought this robot was going to be my new best friend, and I thought this robot was going to sing and dance and play with me. And then the reality of the robot was totally different. I assembled this whole thing. I spent, you know, days, weeks assembling this thing. And there was a little tiny battery pack with a little tiny motor. And so I plug it in and I connect the wires. I plug in the battery and nothing happens. And I was so disappointed in that moment. And I tried all the things I could think of. Like I swapped the batteries and I turned it off and then on again. And I went and got my mother. And I said, "Mom, it's not working." And she said, "Well, did you try turning it on and turning it off again? Try switching the batteries." I said, "Yes." So she looked at it and she said, "Oh, it's broken." And I was very sad. But then she explained that things break and that there are problems in assembly lines. And sometimes parts just don't work as you expect them to. And so then we went and we got a replacement motor and we plugged it in and it did eventually work. But it was very anticlimactic at that point. And so that's the lesson that I've taken with me into every bit of technology that I build. Because I started coding shortly after that. I think I wrote my first program when I was about 11. And so I've been writing computer programs for my entire life, basically. And I do it with the awareness that things break, that pieces don't always work the way that you expect, and that technology is not infallible. And so I think in this new world where we're talking a lot about AI and we're talking about all the things that AI can do, it's really great, but we need to temper it with the awareness that things break and things don't always work the way that you expect.
I think it's such a great story because I think so many people that I know, my parents, some of my friends, I mean, many of my women friends, it's when something doesn't work, they think it's their fault. Well, I just don't know how to use it. Like I'm not good at technology, or, you know, and it's like, well, no, maybe it's not maybe it's broken, or maybe, you know, it needs to be better at understanding how you use it. It's so true. To take the lesson that you learned from that is so important. So you said, you write that by your junior year, you could make a web page, you could spin up a web server, write code in six different programming languages. And for an undergraduate majoring in math, computer science, or engineering, at the time, this was completely normal. For a woman, it wasn't. You were one of six undergraduate women majoring in computer science at a university of 20,000 graduates and undergraduate students. And you only knew two of the other women in computer science. Yeah. So, you know, this is something we hear about a lot. I'd love for you to talk about, like, what was that like? What was that college experience like for you?
It was really lonely. It was lonely and it was alienating. And I could see what the issues were. I could see the pipeline issues happening in real time to me. But I wasn't empowered to make any changes. And since the book came out, I've actually since been introduced to one of the other women computer science majors who I could not find at the time. And she's doing great. Like, she's very successful in her career. I salute her for, and I salute all of the women majoring in computer science at that time for being able to make it through, because the sexism is real. The isolation and the alienation is real. And I think what people don't realize is that the social forces that tell girls that they're not good at science or they're not good at math, those are not just forces that that happen in high school. Those forces start in third grade. As early as third grade, little girls are getting messages that they're not good at science or math, or that boys are better at science and math. And so we really, if we're going to if we're going to have equal representation in STEM fields, we can't just intervene in college and we can't just intervene in high school. We have to intervene all the way along educationally.
And you talk about this in your book. You know, inevitably, when I talk about, you know, few women being in computer sciences, I inevitably get people who say, well, you know, there were only two people in my CS class. There were only, you know, four people in my whole program. And the conclusion that people draw is that women aren't drawn to this. They don't like it. They're not fit for it. They're, you know, whatever it is, whatever way someone can put their foot in their mouth about this. But you say that, I mean, like you're talking about, it starts early, and it's in the language, and just all of this is built in. Talk a little bit about how it's just baked in, not just starting early, but in, you know, in computer science languages and in school. How is that sexism part of the education?
Well, it's so omnipresent. If you think about the stereotypical image of a computer scientist, right? Like, do you picture a woman or do you picture a man?
Mm. Yeah.
And I mean, it's obvious, like, our stereotype of a computer scientist is a man. He's probably in a hoodie. He's probably a white man. He's probably young, right? Now, most computer scientists actually don't look like that, but that's our stereotype. When you think about a stereotype of a mathematician, who pops into your brain? Well, it's probably a man. It's probably a nerdy man with a pocket protector, maybe, if we're going with kind of Hollywood stereotypes. And one of the things that's important to realize is that computer science is a descendant of mathematics. And so math has as much of a gender, has a worse gender problem than a lot of other fields. And so computer science has inherited all of the biases and all of the problems of mathematics. Because until the 1940s, we didn't have computer scientists. All the early computer scientists were mathematicians.
And you say that really, if you want to be a programmer, you don't really need any math higher than sixth or eighth grade math.
Right. You can have a very good career as a programmer nowadays without knowing higher math. So it used to be that computer science required you to do a lot of higher level math, and it doesn't anymore. That's one of the consequences of automation. And computers literally compute. So they're machines for doing math, and so they've gotten very good, or programmers have made excellent programs for camouflaging math, so we can do programming in kind of more human-like language nowadays. So you get to be distanced from the mathematics a lot. So if what I would say to anybody who is watching and is feeling like maybe they don't have the mathematical chops to go into computer science or to get a job as a programmer, I would say that as long as you could handle math up until about eighth grade, you ought to be fine.
That's good advice. I think so much of it has to do with how people explain things. And that's one of the things that struck me with your book. I mean, I gather that it's sort of as I was reading it, I could imagine you standing in front of a group of undergraduates. And I appreciated that because you weren't dumbing it down at all, but you were clearly explaining things. I mean, for example, you go through the way to, you know, the hello world, which is the first thing that everybody learns, of course, and you have the reader write it down with a pen and paper, and then, you know, say it out loud, write it down as a pen and paper, then open up the terminal on your Mac and then show how you do it. How did you choose the audience for this book? Because, I mean, I've read so many books about this that just are either over my head or under my head. And this was just right there where I needed it to be. How did you choose what audience you were going to aim this at?
Oh, well, I'm so glad to hear that, because that's exactly what I was trying to do with the level of the book. I have also had the experience that a lot of technical writing is either like way up here or way down here, and it's kind of not where I need it to be. So I really picked a level for the book that is similar to the level that I use in my classes. So I have very, very bright students in my classes, but nobody knows everything. And it's very important for kind of to be an empowered digital citizen. It's very important to know the foundational concepts inside technology. And what I discovered in the classroom was that K-12 computer science education nowadays often doesn't include the kinds of things that I learned in my K-12 computer science education. So like students are not really learning basic programming anymore. And I found that a lot of students felt really intimidated by something like using the terminal, right? So one of the things that I do in my classes is we do a hands-on exercise where we go into the terminal and we write some Python code and nobody dies. And like, it's a really important lesson that you can do this. So in the book, I take readers through what is it like to do this. And of course, the terminal is much less user-friendly looking than anything else that you use on your computer. So if you're really comfortable in your web browser, maybe you open up the terminal window and it's black and you have to type everything instead of using the mouse. And people sometimes feel intimidated by that. And you don't really have to, but some people do. And so I want people to get over that feeling of anxiety. I want people to feel empowered so that they also feel empowered to say no to computational decisions when those decisions are illogical or unfair.
Yeah, that's so important. I think my experience sometimes with the terminal is like having people say like, oh, don't mess with the terminal. You're going to mess something up. You know, you don't like worry your pretty little head about the terminal. Like, we'll take care of that. It just becomes, now that everything is technology, our door locks and our cars and everything. I mean, you just can't treat it that way. It's, you're doomed if you do. Right. So yeah, it was really nice to have you say, like, just open it up. It's fine. I like, I already trusted you by page 12 or whatever it was where you got that. So,
so good. Well, you know, one of the things I tell my students is the only way you can break your computer is with a hammer.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I do also recommend taking an old computer apart and using a hammer on it and just like opening that thing up and looking at where the wires go in and where the wires go out and how everything is put together.
Yeah, there's some great pictures in the book of, you know, what the inside of a computer looks like. And you do take the hammer to the hard drive, which you say is the only real way to protect your privacy, which is true. And I mean, I think that's so important, too, because I'm on this big kick of like just fixing our stuff instead of upgrading it to something else and just hoping the best for what, you know, our old iPhones. And I just think that's so important. And if you're scared of that, you're just going to keep upgrading. And then we have this giant pile of e-waste that we don't know what to do with. So
exactly. Now, I'm very interested in the right to repair movement. I've been kind of following along as people like farmers advocate for the right to repair their tractors, because tractors are increasingly computerized nowadays. It's a very interesting movement.
Yeah, and it really does dovetail nicely with you, the work that you're doing. And as we were talking before the show started about your key fob battery being burning out, and so you couldn't, you had to figure out how to unlock your door. And I think that is, with the right to repair movement, it's interesting because cars, like, there's laws around, you know, the repair shops of cars that they can, you know, they can know what they're allowed to know what those mysterious car error codes are. But now with iPhones, we're not allowed to know what they mean. You know, it's very closed in system. So
yeah. So
let's talk about artificial intelligence, which is the meat of this, of your book. And by the way, we said, you know, if you think, oh, well, I know how to write Hello World in 26 different programming languages, and you do a good job of saying, like, we'll skip to chapter 4 and, you know, you'll be fine. So you can do that too. So AI, there's two different kinds of AI, the narrow AI and the other one. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between those two?
Sure. So general AI is the Hollywood image of AI. So that's the Terminator, that's the Singularity, that's the robots that are going to take over the world. That's like anything that's about making a little brain inside the computer, making the computer sentient somehow. That's androids. And that's all imaginary. Narrow AI is actually what we have. Narrow AI is real. And narrow AI is just math. It's very, very beautiful math. It's gorgeous and complicated and high-level math, but it's just math. It's basically a computational statistics on steroids. And so it's really important to keep in mind the distinction between narrow and general AI, because when you start imagining, oh, well, the Hollywood image of AI, you know, is real, then we kind of get confused, right? So you need to make sure in conversations about AI that you and the person you're talking to are actually talking about the same thing. Because if you're talking about making the Terminator and I'm talking about predicting whether or not somebody is going to repay their mortgage and, you know, making a decision on a loan, those are two totally different things. And we need to make sure that we are talking about the same thing so that we can be on common ground, especially when we're talking about how to make policy.
And people also now use the term machine learning and AI interchangeably, and you say that's wrong as well.
Oh, yeah. So this is one of the things that I find super interesting. So as a writer, I'm really interested in language. And so but then as a computer scientist, I'm also very interested in precision. I guess as a writer, I'm interested in precision around language as well. But so artificial intelligence is a subfield of computer science, the same way that algebra is a subfield of mathematics. And inside the field of artificial intelligence, There are other subfields. Okay, so machine learning is one subfield of artificial intelligence. Natural language processing is another subfield. Expert systems is another field. But machine learning is the one that's most popular right now. And so most of the time when people say, oh, I'm using AI for business, what they actually mean is that they're using machine learning for business. And so the two terms have become confused. But the other really interesting thing here is the implications of the term artificial intelligence. It makes it sound like there's a little brain inside the computer. Same thing with machine learning. Even though I absolutely know with all of my brain and all of my heart that there is nothing sentient inside this machine, when I hear machine learning, I still think, oh, the machine is maybe learning the way that a human being does, and that is not true. So there's a lot of power in language, and we have to make sure that we respect the fact that language creep happens, and that we still recognize that we're talking about math when we're talking about machine learning.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, like, when you hear that a computer has beaten a chess master or Go master, it's hard to not sort of imagine, like, that they went through the same things that the chess or Go master did, just trying really hard until they got it right and working really hard. And that's not true. You go into detail kind of about how that works and why people use games as a barometer of how well AI is doing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The people who make computer programs and who make machine learning algorithms and who do artificial intelligence, there's been kind of a social thing that's happened inside those fields where most of the people who are in the field really, really like playing games, and they really, really like playing games like chess. And so it came to be that small and homogeneous group of people decided that, oh, smart people play chess, and therefore, if we're going to make a computer that's smart, the computer is going to play chess, and if it wins at chess, then it must be the smartest, and it must be artificially intelligent, which is not true, but it explains why there's been so much effort at getting computers to play chess. I mean, first it was tic-tac-toe, that computers mastered, and then it was checkers, and then it was chess, and then it was Go. And each one of these games is incrementally harder, and it takes decades to figure out how to get a computer to win at these games, at these zero-sum games. And it's a pretty remarkable achievement. But one of the things that I find so interesting about it is that it's about human achievement. So in the book, I go through what it took to get the computer to beat the human expert at Go. And what happened was people play computer Go all the time. Like, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of games of computer Go happening at any given moment. And people have been training for Go tournaments by playing computer Go for years and years. And all of that data gets captured and it gets represented in data sets, right? So we have millions of hours of recorded data on people who are bad and people who are good playing Go all over the world. And so we have all of these permutations. So what the computer scientists did was they took all of that data and they plunked it into the computer. And they said, computer, pick your strategy based on the strategies that have been successful in this data set. And there's actually so much data now that, yes, it is possible to beat the best human Go player. But it's not about the computer using its own strategy that it came up with. It's about the computer using strategies that were created by the best Go players in the world.
So is there
a really
go ahead?
Oh, well, so which I think is a really interesting phenomenon, because we imagine that the computer is autonomously doing something, right? Like, we imagine that the computer has been programmed to make these decisions on its own. But actually, no, it's a totally different paradigm. And it relies on something that is called the unreasonable effectiveness of data. So if you have enough data, you can get a computer to make pretty reasonably accurate guesses about what is going to happen next in very, very highly constrained situations. And the people who are writing these algorithms don't really understand what's going on in the black box, and they can't really express what's going on in the black box. They just know that it works, right? So the unreasonable effectiveness of data describes this phenomenon.
So this is probably where we might start talking about techno-chauvinism, which is one of the major terms that you use in the book. Chauvinism, obviously, just is a gendered term. And it seems to me sort of like a little bit of an old-fashioned term. I thought about the word for a long time because I've never really heard it used in any way besides male chauvinism. But techno, talk a little bit about what techno-chauvinism is and why you chose that word.
So techno-chauvinism is the idea that technology is always the highest and best solution. Techno-chauvinists believe that computer solutions are better than human solutions. In the same way that chauvinists believe that men are better than women at certain things, right? So it's a kind of bias. And techno-chauvinism, of course, has a gender component to it. There's a kind of hefty dose of unacknowledged sexism inside techno-chauvinism. So I have noticed something happening in the past couple of decades where people have started saying things like, making a decision using a computer is better than making a decision through social means because the computer is more unbiased. The computer is more objective. And we believed that for a long, long time, but it's become apparent in the past couple of years that that belief was wrong, that the bias toward using computers over using humans is itself a kind of bias and is dangerous in and of itself. So we have situations like the Compass algorithm, which you're probably familiar with, and that was an algorithm that was used to decide on sentencing and on whether or not somebody would receive bail after they were arrested. And it was a very, very straightforward equation that would take the results of a quiz. So you'd be given this quiz after you were arrested and crunch the numbers on your quiz and give a number that was a recommendation on whether or not you were at risk of reoffending. And, well, it turns out that the algorithm was biased against black people. And mathematically, there was no way for the algorithm to treat black and white people fairly or equally in this situation. So it turns out that even though we imagined at first that we were going to kind of go into the new technological utopia where computers were going to make all of our decisions and it was going to bring about this better world, it actually turns out that the computational world simply reproduces the inequalities of the existing world. And so we live in a world where there is structural racism, well, that gets reproduced inside computational systems. We live in a world where there's profound sexism at every level of society, and that gets reproduced in computational systems. So what I would argue for is, I would argue instead of techno-chauvinism, instead of just assuming that computers do everything better than humans, I would argue that we need to think about what is the right tool for the task. And sometimes that tool is a computer and sometimes that tool is a human. And one is not better than the other. It's situational. And we have the capacity to build these systems that use computers to make decisions and also use humans to make decisions, right? Like it's not an either or proposition.
So the tool, using the right tool, you go into that, that metaphor, that story is about an experiment you did with the Philadelphia school, or an experience you had with the Philadelphia school system, where you had a conversation with someone that said, you know, who said, well, books are always better than, why don't you tell the story about the, I think the conversation started with saying that why, you know, if there aren't enough books, why not just put the books on an iPad or a computer? And that is always better. Talk a little bit about your experience about what the right tool with is for the job in that experience.
Sure. So this investigation started because I was having an argument with my kid. So my kid was in first grade. And he came home with this worksheet, and I said, "Mom, I need help with my homework." And I said, "Sure, of course," because you know I love helping with this homework. And he said, "I need to write down natural resources." And I said, "Oil, gas, coal." And he said, "No, those are not natural resources." I said, "Well, of course they are." And he said, "No, well, that's not what the teacher said in class." And I realized that this was a moment that was about what was the right answer that would get him full credit on the assignment, not what was the right answer in the cosmic sense. Because, of course, I was right, but he was also right. And so I needed to teach him how to do school, not, you know, about oil, gas, and coal. So I said, "Well, let's look in the book. We'll get the right answer by looking in the book." And he said, "Well, there's no book." I said, "Well, of course there's a book. There's always a book. That's how school works." I said, "Well, there is a book, but we're not allowed to bring it home." The teacher would not let them take home the books that they needed to do their homework. And I thought, okay, well, there's got to be an electronic version of this textbook, right? So I spend like 2.5 hours trying to hack into the electronic textbook site because the teacher has forgotten to give us all the password for the electronic textbook site. So it was just like a big mess. And eventually I do help him with homework and it's all totally fine. But I started getting worried because this was in first grade. And I figured if I'm a college professor and I'm having trouble helping my kid with his first grade homework, like by the time he gets to third grade and he has to do the standardized tests, I'm really worried. I'm really worried about how is he going to find out the right answer for the standardized tests if he's not allowed to have the books. And so I started looking at test scores overall in Philadelphia, which is where I was living then. And I asked, well, if Philadelphia public schools have never been able to get more than 50% of their students to pass the standardized tests, is the lack of books part of the problem? Are the students actually getting access to the materials that they need in order to learn the material that's on the state mandated standardized tests? And it turns out that this was a really hard question to answer because there are hundreds of schools, there are thousands upon thousands of students in the schools. The school district is profoundly under-resourced. And in under-resourced school districts, you actually don't have people, you don't have enough people in the schools to keep track of what is physically in the schools. So inventory issues are a really big problem. So I could have stopped there. Perhaps I should have, but I got really interested in this. And I realized that the only way to answer this question of do Philadelphia students have enough books was to build artificial intelligence software. And so I did. And I discovered that indeed schools do not have enough books. And furthermore, the schools did not have enough money in their budget to buy the books that they would need to prepare the students in order to pass the state mandated standardized tests. So it was a big complicated problem. But then there's a digital element to it as well, because we talk a lot about the digital divide, right? Like the conversation about technology in schools used to be about digital divide and who is kind of on which side of the digital divide. But then the conversation moved to, maybe we should just give everybody laptops or iPads and get rid of the physical books. Well, it turns out that people process information differently on screens and on paper. And if you're reading for entertainment, which many of us do, reading electronically is just fine. But if you're reading for comprehension, if you're reading for deep knowledge, print is actually a better interface. And print is actually also a better interface for sitting around in a room and talking about books or talking about ideas. And print is especially a really good interface for a bunch of small children or tweens or teens sitting around and talking about ideas, because a print book is not as exciting as a digital device. You know, I rarely get distracted by the pages in my novel, my printed novel, whereas I get distracted all the time by the blips and beeps of my computer. So in education, as in so many other things, it's really about using the right tool for the task. And sometimes the right tool is a print book, is a codex. It's cheap. It's easy to replace. You can make notes in it. It doesn't run out of power, and it also doesn't take any infrastructure. One of the things that people forget about technology in schools is that it requires a massive amount of effort to keep it going. So it's not just about, let's buy the kids iPads and put all their books on them. You need to have power in the schools. So lots of classrooms don't actually have enough power outlets or enough juice to support 30 odd iPads plugged in all at the same time. Okay, you need to have wireless, and you need to have somebody to maintain it. If you've ever been at a tech conference in a hotel, the wireless quickly gets overwhelmed by the demands of a bunch of hundreds of technologists trying to use it at the same time. And same thing happens in schools when you have like 3 devices per person. You're trying to get them all onto a wireless network at the same time. Like, the wireless network gets overwhelmed. So you need power, you need wireless, you also need HVAC. Okay, you need air conditioning, because computers overheat very easily. And so if you don't have air conditioning in your schools, then you can't run computers. Well, lots and lots of urban public schools don't have air conditioning. And in Philadelphia specifically, the schools close often in the summertime because of excessive heat. And they don't have the money to put in air conditioning, and they don't have the necessary power to put in air conditioning. So I thought this story was just about books, but it was about so much more. And it's all wrapped up together. And so when we're thinking about technology issues, we're really thinking about big social issues. And we need to consider a lot of things all at once.
So you called it the Institutional Materials Refresh Program, which meant maybe some computers and maybe some books. How did that go? Is the project done?
They did allocate several million dollars to instructional materials refresh. So I was thrilled to see that. I do not think that the problem is fixed entirely, however.
I was hoping you'd say it was. The whole public school education system was fixed, but not yet, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I tried.
We didn't talk about what you do now, that you're a data journalist. I kind of skipped past that. Now, you were a computer science major at Harvard. And then how did you was data journalism a subject at that point?
No, it wasn't. I wish that it were. So data journalism is a term that dates to about 2006. And it is the current incarnation of what we used to call computer-assisted reporting. That was a term that came about in the 80s when reporters all got computers on their desktops for the first time. And people started doing reporting with spreadsheets and with databases. And then before that, it was called precision reporting, which actually dates to 1968, which is the first time that the tools of social science were used in investigative reporting. So Phil Meyer, a pioneer in the field, used a mainframe computer to crunch some survey data and do an investigative story about the Detroit race riots. So there's a pretty reasonably long history of using computers for investigative journalism purposes. And so data journalism is the most recent incarnation of that. So what I do is I write computer code in order to commit acts of investigative reporting. I do a kind of reporting that's called algorithmic accountability reporting. And so there are two ways to do it. One way is like what ProPublica does or what Julia Engwin does with her new newsroom, The Markup. And that is investigating algorithms, black box algorithms that are used to make decisions on our behalf, right? So that's the compass algorithm or the algorithm that is used to decide if you are worthy of getting a new credit card or the algorithms that decide who gets into which New York City public high school. Right, so that's investigating algorithms that are out there. I do the other side of that, which is I write my own algorithms in order to investigate social issues. So it's a relatively new field in the sense that we are using advanced computational methods for investigative journalism nowadays.
And so you mentioned Julia Engwin, who used to be at ProPublica and now started her own thing. So is that what she used to uncover? I know she was the one that I think uncovered the ads that were racist in Facebook and other things like that. Is that data journalism?
Yes, that is data journalism, and that is algorithmic accountability reporting. That's a particular strain of it. Sorry, we're getting really wonky here right now. I'm putting on my journalism professor hat. There are lots of people who are investigating platforms. So tech platforms have all of the same problems that everything else in the real world has, and they need to be held accountable in the same way. So people are starting to do investigative reporting projects on the different tech platforms in order to find out how are these platforms discriminating against citizens? What are the threats to democracy posed by things happening on these platforms? What is illegal activity that's happening on these platforms? So that's a very important function that journalism serves in a democracy, is finding these things out so citizens can be more aware and can be empowered. And so journalists now are looking at tech like we look at anything else in the world, and we're saying, okay, let's be realistic about the problems that we find.
So one of the things that, I mean, I completely understand techno-chauvinism, and once reading this book, I see it everywhere all the time, and it's great to have a name for it. The one chapter in here that really surprised me is about self-driving cars, because I'm someone that has been saying, like, they cannot come soon enough. Hopefully before my kids get their driver's license, that hasn't happened. I have a daughter with a permit, and so apparently it's not going to happen soon enough for me. And I always think, well, you know, yes, computers are better than humans. They're not going to text. They're going to be safer. But you sort of blew my mind on that, too. Before I let you go, talk a little bit about what we're missing by saying that self-driving cars are right around the corner and it can't come soon enough.
Well, people have been saying self-driving cars are coming soon for decades, actually, which really surprised me. I thought that self-driving cars dated to the DARPA Grand Challenge, you know, only about a decade ago. But it turns out that no, people have been working on this for a very, very long time. They've also been working on flying cars for a really long time, and that has also not happened, you know, much to many people's chagrin. I am unfortunately not one of those people who is super excited about flying cars, but I respect that other people are. So self-driving cars are like any other technology. And I got interested in them a few years ago when I was writing a story for the University of Pennsylvania Alumni Magazine about the Penn driving team, Penn self-driving car team. And so I went for a ride in their self-driving car, which they were preparing for the DARPA Grand Challenge. And I thought I was going to die or vomit or both simultaneously. It was the most terrifying experience. And so I realized, like, oh, I don't really trust these people to make a self-driving car that's not going to kill people. And so I kind of forgot about it for years. But then I realized that, oh, there's all this rhetoric about self-driving cars coming to market soon. And it's these same dudes who almost killed me in the parking lots. So, I mean, because of this experience, I have different perspective than most people, right? Like, most people have not been in a self-driving car. Most people have only seen videos of them, or they've, like, been on test drives in very, very highly controlled situations. So when you look at the code that is being used in self-driving cars, when you look at the people who are making the code that goes into self-driving cars, when you look at the data that's being used to train self-driving cars, it is not as robust as you imagine. Okay, so the for example, the image recognition algorithms that are used, you know, that the cars use in order to recognize objects in the real world and respond to them, are very, very easily defeated, right? So, like, the car needs to use its sensors to take in data and take in the picture of the stop sign at the corner, and then trigger a subroutine that makes the car slow down and stop at the line before the stop sign, right? So if I were to go around and put a sparkly unicorn sticker onto a stop sign, the car would stop recognizing the stop sign as a stop sign. Like, it would not trigger the subroutine, and then the car would drive through the intersection and cause an accident, which is terrible, because, like, I see stop signs in disrepair and I see street signs in disrepair all the time. I mean, I live in New York City. Like, stuff is not in great repair. Like, the lines are all worn off of the roads. And so we need things like lines on the roads, and we need pristine street signs if self-driving cars are going to work. But that's not the world that we live in. And it's definitely not a world that we're going to live in anytime soon if we still can't get books to kids in schools because we don't have enough electricity in the schools. So it's about systems. So self-driving cars do not work as well as you think. There are problems with these systems. And then there's also the problem of what happens when you take away the driver in a rideshare situation. Mm. Now, I actually do not, I do not think that there are any women out there who want to get into an autonomous rideshare alone with some strange man in the middle of the night. So, like, let's say you want to take a rideshare home after you've been, like, out at the bars, and you want to take a rideshare back to Brooklyn because the rideshare is cheaper than taking it by yourself. Well, getting into a car with a strange man in the middle of the night is not something that sounds safe. Mm-hmm. So we still have the social problems of, you know, of people in the world. And right now, the reason that we can do ride shares and the reason that, you know, it's fine taking a ride share home late at night is that there's a driver. Mm-hmm. And the driver is there to mediate any problems. So when you take away the driver, you're taking away an essential part of the social contract. And that also does not seem safe.
Yeah. It's the same when someone talks about an autonomous school bus, too, which is like this driver not just
terrifies
there
me.
Yeah, to drive the bus.
Right.
That's not his main job.
Why on earth would you want like 50 children on like in a machine all by themselves? Like if we don't let kids cross the street by themselves, like why on earth are we thinking about putting them into a bus mm-hmm. by themselves? It's going to be like Lord of the Flies in there.
So the way we got the hype around self-driving cars or ride share, that has to do with so much that you've written about, Marvin Minsky, and just how like the history of just not people not thinking about what did you think would happen. So I won't get that. That's all stuff that you'll have to read in the book. But before we go, okay, I understand that techno-chauvinism is bad, but we don't want to be Luddites, and you're not a Luddite. So talk a little bit about the middle range. You call it like human in the loop systems. That's the positive point of this. Let's end with that.
Yeah. So there are two kinds of systems that the people generally talk about. There are autonomous systems and human in the loop systems. So autonomous systems operate without any human intervention. And so that's like the Facebook fantasy of, oh, we'll write some AI tools that will just like monitor, what people are doing on the platform, and we won't need to have humans intervening at all. Or that's the fantasy of, oh, I'm going to use my app to call a car, a self-driving car, and I'll just get in it and it'll take me somewhere. And then it will just like disappear, right? So that's the autonomous fantasy. Whereas what I would argue for is a human in the loop system. And in a human in the loop system, a human is an integral part of the system. So that's what we have in current driving. So maybe you have like a parking assist feature in your car. Like there are cars that that have parallel parking systems that, you know, it's very good. It's like a small and finite exercise in geometry. Or there are cars that will beep when you veer out of your lane. And that's also really, some people find that really helpful, right? So I would encourage people to think about designing systems for humans, designing systems that account for human frailty, for human fallibility, that allow for governance, and that are systems that embrace humanity as opposed to systems that try and shove humanity out of the way and make the world more convenient for machines. Because humans are the point.
Humans are the point. Meredith Broussard, thank you so much for joining us. Meredith Broussard is the author of Artificial Unintelligence, How Computers Misunderstand the World. She's a data journalist, a NYU professor. Just check out her book. It's in hardcover now, coming out in paperback. It's amazing. It's about the stuff we talk about on this network all the time, but just really well-researched, amazing, and funny, really funny. I laughed out loud at a lot of parts, especially I love when you chose one of your partners in the startup bus because of his laptop stickers. So
thank you so much.
Thank so you
great
so
to
much.
Be here.
Thank you. Take care. Have a great day.
Have a great day.
Thank you. And thank you for watching Triangulation. Every week we talk to the brightest, most interesting, fascinating people writing about tech, working in tech, solving the world's problems, but really solving them, which often means like these are very difficult problems to solve, and let's just talk about them. So thank you for joining us. I'm Megan Maroney. You can download the show at twit.tv/try. You can watch us live. We usually record Fridays at 3 p.m., but you never know when you can catch us live on the stream, so you can always watch that twit.tv/live and join us in the chat room, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.